Today on Conflict, 12 weeks of examples in 1 hour. Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, December 2nd, 2003, and coming to you live from WGMU in George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict. Welcome to episode 13 of Conflict, Radio for Resolution. I'm Sean Dunning. Over the past 3 months, we have explored numerous examples of effective, nonviolent, non-adversarial, and cooperative, otherwise constructive, approaches for addressing something that necessarily affects every person on this planet, conflict. Have we discovered a panacea? Hardly. Have we scratched the surface? Perhaps. Have we made a difference? I suppose only time will tell. But if you are listening now, there's a reason for it. This may be your first time tuning in. It may be your last. Perhaps you have been an avid listener from the beginning. No matter what, you have an interest, as everyone does, in learning about effective approaches to addressing conflict. And since conflict affects every person, we can each learn something valuable. For 12 weeks, I have enjoyed the pleasure of learning a lot about fascinating perspectives and innovative examples pertaining to conflict resolution. And lucky for me, all I had to do was invite expert guests onto the program. Today's show is dedicated to those guests. These are their stories. And for those of you who may not have had the time to listen through all 12 hours of programming up to this point, here's your chance to get a taste of what we cover. Consider this the Cliff Notes of Conflict, episodes 1 through 12. As always, for archived versions of entire programs, visit www.conflictradio.org. We begin with Episode 1, way back on September 2nd. Before taking on the task of showcasing effective tools for addressing conflict, we thought it was appropriate to first ask the question, what is conflict? We heard results from a street poll conducted in Washington, D.C. regarding everyday perceptions of conflict and its effects, but we also got our bearings right here at George Mason University by literally walking around campus and asking students what they thought. Here's what some of them said.
When you think of the term conflict, what comes to mind?
Well, two people that have a problem with each other and they have to work it out somehow. There's different resolutions that they come to, or they could fight about it or have a war or just resolve it peacefully.
So I'm just going around campus asking folks what they think about conflict. When you hear the word conflict, what comes to mind? What does that mean to you?
To me, that means anybody who, or any sort of thing where people disagree or can't come to an agreement in a certain situation.
Competition. Whenever I think about the word conflict, I think about resolution of conflict. We need to concentrate on resolving them instead of just like pointing them out and just sort of allowing them to fester. We need to work as a community to sort of try to nullify all of the conflicts that we have.
If you need to resolve something and you just let it go, then it's going to be not resolved, obviously, so.
Everybody has different opinions, and I think it's not good to be so narrow-minded.
I think that concentrating on why we have conflict is going to be one of the keys in resolving it.
Can you imagine conflict ever as a positive thing?
Yes.
Yes, I could say that. It helps you understand where the other person is coming from, you know, because sometimes you have your own viewpoint on a certain situation. You see it from one side, the other person, even though it's a disagreement, they kind of enlighten you to another way of looking at something. And sometimes it makes you think, and you're like, okay, you know, it could be both ways. That's why we're bumping heads right now. I can see their point of view, too. So
right.
Makes you more well-rounded sometimes if it's used properly, basically.
There's so many different forms of conflict. Like, for example, this is a card game. You can call this conflict because I'm playing against another person, and the point is to win. And, you know, to have fun, whatever. But, I mean, the point, you know, the general idea is you're going to try and beat the other person through, you know, camaraderie, whatever. But, you know, there's other kinds of conflict that are obviously not good. That, I mean, so you can't generalize it in a big block and just say, conflict, this is the block of conflict. You have to say, you know, because some people are going to compete with each other in some way or other at certain points.
I guess it just depends on the situation, what the outcome would be.
I think, you know, at the end of any given situation, disagreement, conflict, or what have you, that there's basically two ways you can judge it, is if the people come away better for it with a new understanding or more knowledge in a particular area, or if it's merely destructive and there's hard feelings and everything like that. So I think on one hand, conflict can be a very beneficial thing because people can improve themselves over it, and then on the other hand, it can be a very destructive. But in the end, it just really matters on the person's maturity and how they act towards it.
After setting the stage for exploration, we briefly turned our attention to introducing the host of Conflict, myself. But instead of talking for an entire hour about myself, I showcased music from an international performing arts and community service organization which I spent a year of my life. The organization is called Up With People, and some of you may recognize this classic song from Up With People's 38-year history of building friendship and understanding around the world.
Down the street, yeah. When a bus driver and a shopkeeper and a teacher I happened to meet there in every window and in every single store. I recognize people I never noticed before.
Up with people.
Listening to Conflict on WGMU Radio, 650 AM in Fairfax, Virginia, and worldwide on WGMUradio.com. Today we are reviewing some of the highlights from the last 3 months of our show, and now we continue with Episode 3. After setting the stage and introducing the host, we jumped right into showcasing innovative approaches to addressing conflict. And to kick it off, we were joined live in studio by local peace activist Andy Shalal, who shared with us his ongoing Israeli-Palestinian dialogue project, the Peace Cafe. Here's Andy explaining the basics.
And so we set up this little cafe, we called it the Peace Cafe, outside in the lobby of the theater. When people were done seeing the play, they came out. They sat down in groups of about six or seven people in round tables. We had some food. We had food that both Arabs and Jews enjoy, like hummus and things like that. We had pita bread for people to break and share. We had dates and figs and all kinds of wonderful foods from the Middle East. And we also had menus on the table. We called them Food for Thought, and it was little excerpts from the play. So people had the opportunity to look at the menu and be able to think up of topics that they may have forgotten while watching the play and talk to each other. We started by having each person introduce themselves. Then we broke bread in the tradition of all the Abrahamic religions, passed the bread around, and shared the hummus and other goodies that were on the table. Suddenly, the walls sort of come down, and people are more apt to listen and hear each other and talk. The play acted as a foundation, a sort of a conduit for the dialogue, and it was very, very effective, so much so that we decided to do it every single night after every single showing of the play, and suddenly we were having people come back another night and another night and wow. wanted to be involved more and more. So that's how it started.
And when was that, the first one?
It started about 3.5 years ago.
And when you did that, after that initial play, did you have the idea in mind to continue doing these dialogues?
Well, yes. The uniqueness of the Peace Cafe is the fact that the audience has a shared experience, such as a play. And we thought, well, David Harris' play is a wonderful way to do that because it's a one-man show. In fact, we brought it here to George Mason University also. There was a showing here at George Mason that we had about 400 people come to it. And then we had dialogues afterwards. It was very good as well. But the shared experience is very important for a Peace Cafe type of dialogue because it's hard to put people on the same page mm-hmm. and start a conversation from scratch. And a play was a perfect opportunity to do that because we don't listen to each other. We as Arabs and Jews tend to stay within our own communities, talk to each other about one another. But we never talk, we never sort of have any inter-community dialogues. And the play, like any other performance, basically forces the audience to just be quiet and listen. Hmm. And it's an hour and a half show. There's no talking back. You have to listen. And listening is the beginning to understanding. And so it really does create an opening for conversation that otherwise you wouldn't be able to have just to walk into a cold room and start talking.
After our episode with Andy Shillel talking about the Peace Cafe, we moved on to a very interesting guest, Tom Dunn. Mr. Dunn used to be a Navy SEAL, career Navy SEAL, and he made an interesting transition in his life and is now a cooperative problem-solving expert. It was a fascinating program hearing some stories from his days in the SEAL teams, and now some of his work with transforming how the world deals with conflict away from adversarial approaches and more towards cooperative solutions. And here we have a short clip with him talking about how he made that switch and a little explanation of what cooperative problem solving is. What took you from being a Navy SEAL to a cooperative problem solving expert?
Sure. Well, no, I get asked that question a lot. It's a fair question. And from my perspective, there's a lot that the military and the people in conflict resolution have in common. They're both involved in solving problems. We used to jokingly say in the teams that there's no problem that cannot be resolved with an adequate amount of plastic explosives. So what we differ on isn't a fundamental purpose, and I think that allows for a lot of respect between those communities.
What is cooperative problem solving?
As the name indicates, it's a process of acknowledging that you and I have a problem, that's a normal, welcome to the real world, people have problems, and that there is a possibility that if I can decide to attack the problem rather than attacking you right out of the box, and perhaps listen to your point of view, what a concept, very simple but radically
Wait, back up. But I'm right. I mean, come on. What if I'm right? Why? You know, why should I listen to you? I mean, I have the answer.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm very interested in hearing your answer. As a matter of fact, why don't you talk to me a little bit about what is it that you want in this situation?
Wow.
You mean you're going to listen to me?
Well, I definitely want to listen to you. I'm not saying that I'm going to agree with you, but I am absolutely committed to not only listening to, but understanding your point of view. And who knows? It may well be that we can find some solution.
Yeah, I've got to tell you. Well, after having a little fun with Mr. Tom Dunn, cooperative problem-solving expert, we moved on to showcasing another innovative program, and our guest on the show for Episode 5 was Dr. Amer Abdallah, and Dr. Abdallah is a professor right here at George Mason University and an expert in conflict resolution, and he shared with us a project that he is working on called Project Light, and we'll listen to him talk about it right here. What is Project Light?
LIGHT stands for Learning Islamic Guidance for Human Tolerance. The idea of this project emerged last year. It's pretty much related to the events after September 11. As we all know, unfortunately, there were incidents when groups of Muslims, Arabs, and people from South Asia were treated improperly. And there were incidents of attacks on some of those people. So the project that we proposed to do was based on empowering Muslims to understand very well the concepts of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in their own religion. We wanted to make sure that we would bring a group of Muslims from the Washington area, and we give them very specific intensive education on the concepts of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in Islam, to the point that we make sure that they are completely convinced that this is what Islam is really about.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the first stage of our program. The second stage would be to train this group of Muslims in how to go out and do workshops or outreach meetings with non-Muslim peers to tell them about those messages of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in Islam. Because I feel like we are up against a media that, unfortunately, most of the time, sending a message about Islam that depicts someone like Bin Laden on TV mm-hmm. for 5 minutes and makes people think that this is what every Muslim is or are, and emphasizing that the terror and the violence. And we needed to make sure that people understand that that's not the picture. This is not really what we are, the vast, vast majority of Muslims. Mm-hmm. We are about peace. We are about love. We are about tolerance. And we wanted people to understand how we understand our religion, how we live our religion as Muslims, mm-hmm. as American Muslims. So we selected 40 people who are ordinary people. They are not like experts or scholars or anything. And we made sure that our sample was selected equally among men and women. Also, we have people who are as young as high school age and as old as 70 plus.
Mm-hmm.
All those are in our group. And we did this kind of grounding workshop with them to talk about issues of peaceful coexistence and tolerance in Islam. And that worked very, very well, and it was beautiful. And then we got them to the stage of training them. We divided them into groups of four. So we have 10 teams. Each team is mm-hmm. made of 3 to 4 people. And we train them on a specific curriculum that they can do in about an hour or an hour and a half to address issues of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in Islam. One important element in how we designed our training was to stay away from the boring lecture-type mm-hmm. presentation.
Right.
We knew very well that we as a Muslim community, we need to learn to develop new approaches to communicate messages other than sending someone who would just stand there for half an hour, 45 minutes, just talk and talk and talking. We needed to do something different. Having lived in America, having been around academia for the last 15, 16 years, I have been fascinated by all those new approaches to learning and training mm-hmm. Using role plays and using simulations and stuff like this seem to be very effective in sending messages. So I thought that's what we need to do. So myself and my team, we worked together on developing an hour and a half workshop that is full of fun and activities and interactive things we do and role plays. And during those processes, we communicate those messages to people. And we ultimately finish our workshop by getting together with a group of non-Muslim peers, and we talk about what action plans can we make in order to address issues of discrimination together.
Hmm.
So right now, where we are with Project Light is We finished training all our the group of Muslims, and they are all ready to go. We already did one or two workshops, and I think they were received very, very well, and people were pleased with the style and how we did them. And right now, we are ready to go and do 60 workshops. That's what we committed to do. We're going to do 60 workshops in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. We are doing them in high schools, in colleges, in workplaces, in police stations, fire stations, anywhere. Anywhere that there are people who want to listen to this message. We will be glad to go and communicate this message. And also, we want to send it via radio and TV programs like we're doing right now.
Good afternoon. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Conflict on WGMU Radio, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, 650 AM and worldwide on WGMUradio.com. Today is our highlights show, so in case you have not heard all of the past 12 episodes, here's your chance to get at least a glimpse of what was covered. We'll now move on to Episode 6, Cultural Conflict and Western Medicine. We had two guests on the program that day, Dr. Tom Resk, a forensic pathologist in Northern California, and Dr. Linda Johnston, a professor right here at George Mason University. We covered a few topics, and the first half of the program was dedicated to a really interesting and innovative, heroic, if I may say, attempt by this forensic pathologist, Dr. Resk, out in Chico, California, to kind of bridge the cultural gap between the Hmong community and the Western medicine community. And specifically, this had to do with forensic autopsies. And so here we're going to hear a short clip from Dr. Resk on a phone interview I had with him talking about an initial meeting he had with a Hmong family who was concerned about one of their family members recently passing away, and more specifically concerned about the fact that an autopsy had been done on her. And so we'll hear what kind of mutual understanding came out of that meeting.
When you held this first meeting, it sounds like there were a lot of concerns up front. Of those concerns, what was alleviated, or what do you feel that meeting accomplished in terms of generating mutual understanding?
Well, actually, two things, Sean. There were some feelings that were addressed up front, but really what I was able to do is I was able to respond to their directly expressed concerns, of course, but then also having done a little research into it and realizing that there were some other issues that they may have been, in fact, too polite to bring up. For example, the concern and the fear among a number of Hmong people that, in fact, during an autopsy, organs are taken or stolen, in fact, by a person such as myself, a forensic pathologist, and then might be given away or sold for organ donor purposes. So there's definitely a patent fear for that, or that organs are kept by the pathologist and not returned to the body, which would be a big objection, as well as whether or not metal objects, scalpel blades, for example, might be left in the body, which would make the body unacceptable to the spirit world. And I think probably the bottom line is that they were able to come away with an understanding and appreciation of why specifically their 66-year-old family member, why it was necessary to do an autopsy on that person. But beyond that, I think they came away with a wider understanding and broader appreciation of the role of the forensic autopsy in Western culture. And I know that particular meeting was able to satisfy some of the fears that were not directly expressed, but I know existed because of various members of the Hmong community I'd had a chance to talk to before having this meeting with this Hmong family.
Now we'll move on to, we'll hear a clip from the second portion of the program on cultural conflict and Western medicine with our guest, Dr. Linda Johnston, professor of conflict analysis and resolution and expert in cultural conflict associated with public health matters. Here she gives an example that might seem all too simple, yet surprisingly profound.
And I think all it takes is for groups to sit down together and to talk very honestly about what those concerns are.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of situations like that that you've dealt with?
Yes. My first real encounter with this was with the Montagnards when they came from Vietnam. And I can remember coming into clinic one night and all of us working all night because we had a whole plane full of mm-hmm. people that had come in and we were processing paperwork and that kind of thing all through the night. And one of the things that came up was we had a very, very sick baby that came. And the mother was extremely fearful of all these people in the white jackets and all the stethoscopes and all of these kinds mm-hmm. of things, which, of course, she had never seen before. And she was asking the translator, who were these people and what were they going to be doing to her baby? Because it was obvious, I think, to her that we were all concerned about her baby, which obviously was suffering from kwashiorkor and masmerus. And it was really interesting that she was listening to the translator talk about all of the degrees that these people had and all of their medical training and all of that. And she listened for about 10 minutes to this, and then she said, who among this group of people has children and understands me? And none of them except me had children. And so she said to them, well, then none of you are qualified to tell me what to do with mm-hmm. my child. And, of course, I was kind of on the low end of the totem pole in terms of degrees and experience mm-hmm. in this particular situation. And yet she was trusting me because I had children. Therefore, I knew what to do. And I respect my coworkers in that sense because they stepped back from that. And they essentially talked through me to tell the woman what needed to be done. And so we finally got the baby hospitalized and we were able to resolve the situation. And the mother went to the hospital with the baby and she was able to stay right there with the baby. And the translator went with her also. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one example where we went with her belief system, but we also got what we needed for her and for the baby.
Now we move on to one of the most production-intensive programs to date, a showcase of the Common Ground Film Festival. Not only were we joined in the studio by festival director Susan Kostas, we also heard from four film directors themselves, speaking to us on the telephone from as far away as Israel. If that wasn't enough to paint a picture of the Common Ground Film Festival, we even featured clips from some of the films. Here, Susan Kostas is explaining the Common Ground criteria for films. What is the Common Ground Film Festival?
Well, the festival is really comprised of a series of individual films that I and some of my colleagues at Search for Common Ground have found. And the films, each one in its own way, finds common ground or at least makes a very good attempt to look for it, to search for it, to establish it. It's the way a common ground film really is about the way that the filmmaker tells hers or her story. And what I mean by that is that the story is told in a way that is balanced. It reflects both sides of an issue or more sides if there's more than two sides. Mm-hmm. It respects the opinions and the feelings and the attitudes of both peoples in the conflict. It respects them. It treats them with dignity.
And now let's hear from director Diane Bloom of the film entitled An Unlikely Friendship.
First, if you could just tell me a little bit about your film, An Unlikely Friendship.
The film is about two people who were complete polar opposites. One was the exalted grand cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan, the leader of the Ku Klux Klan in Durham, North Carolina, and the other is a black woman, welfare mom, and civil rights activist, and they hated each other, but when they were brought together to co-chair a school desegregation meeting together, they got to know each other as humans instead of stereotypes, and they became lifelong friends. And he also renounced the Klan and paid the price for that. So it was an interesting and different kind of story.
Now, Diane, as a filmmaker, you certainly have a lot of choices of what you could do. I mean, it's a very creative medium, and certainly you can allow your creativity to take you in any direction you want. Why did you choose to do a story like this?
You know, it was so different than the other things I've done, which have been more features and more light and humorous. And somehow, I think because I grew up, the story touched me. And I think because, you know, there have been so many meetings in Durham, North Carolina in 30 years, but this is one people still talk about, and they still talk about it because it was so unusual. And I grew up in a town, a beach town in New Jersey, where it was and still is a completely white community. And the only people of color that I saw growing up were the maids that came into the community to, you know, babysit with the white children or work in the families of the white people. And I saw how very subtle racism, you know, values were transferred from parent to kids, and not even intentionally, but just, you know, just subtly transferred. And I think I've always been fascinated by, you know, how people get their values and how people form stereotypes. So, you know, between that and also between the fact that these people changed, and that was just so amazing to me. It was the hope, you know, I think it was hope that if those two people who were so complete polar opposites could do it, then it could make peace with each other and even come to love each other, then anybody could, given the right circumstances.
Well, if that piqued your curiosity, here is a very short clip from the end of Diane Bloom's film, An Unlikely Friendship. Here you're going to hear the former KKK leader and his unlikely friend, a black civil rights activist, reflect on the past.
So I had to laugh, but you know, and every one of them was just as nice to me. How in the hell does people get so screwed up mentally? They don't have any evidence to some of the things that they do and some of the opinions they make. They just have them.
We've made it through these years together, 30 years, and we're still friends.
I really love her as an individual. And she got every time I go down there, I had to hug her neck and hug her younger's neck and hug the old man's neck. How in the hell does anybody believe a story like this?
A lot of people still, you know, don't understand quite how this happened, but it did happen, and we bonded, and we are still bonded.
For episode 8, we took a little side trip from the journey of exploring techniques for resolving conflict and met with someone who is working on a master's degree in conflict analysis and resolution. We wanted to understand what motivates a person to choose such an educational path and what they might hope to accomplish. Instead of just talking with some 24-year-old idealist, however, we met lifelong resident of the Washington, D.C. area and retired federal employee, Jean Wilson. Here's a little of what she had to say. Now, Jean, earlier you mentioned that if you had made your decision, or if you had gone into college directly after high school, you might have done education. And certainly you like children. You're good with children. You have three of your own. And you certainly strike me as someone who would make a fantastic teacher. But you chose conflict resolution. How did you come to make that decision for conflict resolution?
Well, as a parent and a grandmother, too, you know, you're always managing conflicts. No, in the ICAR, we call that third-party mediator. But I guess I've always been doing that all my adult life, whether it was with my brother or sisters or with my children. But I came to realize that, you know, working with children and interpersonal relationships, but it's not only with the children. It's just learning more about what's going on in the world, finding out that, no, I'm not in this little cocoon by myself. There is a big world out there that needs, you know, needs some kind of help.
Now for some more heartfelt examples of people making a difference in the world, child and youth conflict expert Michael Shipler joined the program on October 28th and told this touching story from his time in Cambodia.
Ren lost his family and grew up an orphan. Another fellow by the name of Kat, he grew up with family, but when the Vietnamese took over, spent well over a year running through the forests and the mountains, eating branches off trees. When I would travel with Kat through the countryside, he would just take a branch off a tree and be like, "Hey, Mike, eat this." And then two other young people, Makara and Muni, and they they had this vision that there was some other role for youth, that youth were actually not the hope of the future and all that, but they were the here and now. They were the ones who weren't as devastated in some ways or wrapped up in what had happened. They were just purely, everything had happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was their responsibility now, here and now and today, to actually transform Cambodia's way of dealing with violence. And so they set upon this slow course of rebuilding the culture, of rebuilding the values, of rebuilding moral character. And they work with other youth. They started under a tree holding discussions about relationships between Cambodia and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Very dangerous work, actually. Mm-hmm. They got shut down. They had this and that happened to them, but they worked. And then they found, they were very lucky, they got connected with an NGO, a Cambodian organization, that gave them an opportunity to actually have a space. And they got a little bit of funding from two groups, one American Friends Service Committee and the other one the Mennonite Central Committee, and they got $1,000. With $1,000, they operated for 1 year.
Wow.
They worked for 300 youth doing peace-building conflict resolution trainings and education opportunities. They reused
masking. And they were completely self-organized. These were just youth working together.
Yep. They just had this mm-hmm. idea. They wanted to do it. They were victims of war. They were participants of war. They wanted to change it. They wanted to change the environment. Wanted to have an impact on the environment that they were living in, and they knew that it was their generation's job.
Mm-hmm.
And they still believe that, and they're still operating. And I got a letter the other day from Ren, and he was off, you know, facilitating a meeting with a former president of Indonesia. I mean,
wow.
He has gone in, you know, they have gone in 4 years from, you know, being sitting on straw mats in the garage of another organization to, you know, meeting with the president of the World Bank. And I mean, and there are still youth, and there's, you know, and the thing that's great about them is that the participants who come through their program, many of them end up as actual leaders and then staff members. So mm-hmm. it's fully youth-run, youth-initiated, youth-oriented, youth-owned. You know, young people own it themselves. It's theirs. It's their generation's movement.
In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to Conflict on WGMU Radio coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. You can pick us up on 650 AM right here on campus or GMU Cable Channel 22 or anywhere in the world on WGMUradio.com. And I should mention that over the last 3 months, I've heard from all kinds of folks all over the world, from Switzerland and Belgium and Sweden and Denmark down to Spain. I've heard from folks in Africa, from South Africa, even Ghana. We've heard from folks in Asia. We've heard from people in Indonesia and Japan. And these are just people who have been tuning in on online to get the live webcast. And just a reminder, you can go anytime to www.conflictradio.org and listen to this as well as all the other full version episodes of Conflict. And you can catch them right there on the streaming MP3s. Well, we're going to move on here, and we're going to move to Episode 10. The title of Episode 10 was A Conversation About Conflict, and this wasn't just any old conversation. We met with Carol Frampton and Kate Levanche, who are the directors of a very innovative approach to building understanding, kind of an initial understanding of conflict. And their basic premise was that before we can do anything about conflict, we need to understand it. And they have begun a project entitled The Conversation About Conflict. And here they are, Carol Frampton and Kate Levanche, sharing a little bit about what that is. What is a conversation about conflict? And that's with a capital C and mm-hmm. another capital C.
Well, it's exactly what the title says. It is just a conversation. Just to explain maybe a little bit how we came to this idea is that we realized that we can talk about conflict resolution. Very few people actually know what conflict resolution is, but very few people even have a concept of what conflict is. They don't really think about how we deal with conflict as an issue in itself. And our vision was to promote cooperative approaches to conflict, conflict resolution, alternative dispute resolution, all these different processes and skills that help us with conflict. But we realized, well, we have to first start by having a conversation about conflict before we can promote these approaches. And that's how the very first idea of this conversation came about. And it's basically a kind of a dialogue or facilitated discussion that lasts about an hour to 2 hours on the issues of conflict, an opportunity for people to get their head around the idea of conflict, how mm-hmm. they deal with it, mm-hmm. Their personal experiences of it.
I think what Carol said about personal experiences is really the key to this, and why so many people who have participated have been so engaged in the dialogue, and they don't mm-hmm. want it to stop, you know. It's really, we're so inundated, particularly these days, with conflict around the world. I mean, anytime you turn the news on, it's on, you know, nonstop 24 hours a day. And the conversation about conflict actually gives us an opportunity to step back and look at conflict in our own lives, how it impacts us, you know, in our communities, with our families, in our workplaces. And I think it really provides people who may feel somewhat helpless in impacting what's going on in the world, you know, giving them actually some hope and some ability to maybe impact how conflict's handled it in their own life, which will impact in the world ultimately. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing to talk about ideas and projects and to hear about all the great success stories, but it's another thing altogether to hear a success story from a participant themselves. We had the opportunity on episode 10 with Carol and Kate to actually have some phone conversations with some folks who had participated in conversations about conflict. And here is one of them, and we'll just hear a short clip from a participant from a conversation about conflict, reflecting upon the difference that it made with her.
The dialogue really asked us, each one of us, to kind of consider what we believed.
And after having this reflection and raising your awareness and having kind of a better understanding of how you viewed conflict and how it affected your personal life, did this result in any actual changes in your personal life?
Yes, it did. One of the tools that I took from the dialogue were the propositions at the end.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, there are five of them, and they were really easy for me to bundle up and take with me. And they're that conflict is a normal part of life. It's neither positive nor negative. It offers a choice. We can learn how to better deal with it, and that we can each make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of was able to tighten that in my head after the dialogue and really apply it later. I was in a situation with a contractor. I was in the process of doing some collaborating with a contractor on the rehabilitation of a house, and we were very, very behind schedule, and I was getting very anxious, and I was beginning to see the problem as the contractor, and that was making it very personal rather than it being just a business situation that could be handled, that we could creatively problem solve around. And I remember showing up to meet him and expecting a deadline to be met, and it wasn't. And I remember just thinking immediately, I need to take a deep breath, and I pulled from my toolbox those five propositions and thought, yeah, this can turn out better. I know what the outcome is that I want, and blowing off steam and making him feel bad isn't going to get me that outcome. So I said, give me a second. You know, I left the house, kind of did a 360 walk around it, collected my thoughts, and went back up and was able to reach the outcome that I wanted to with him without making it personal.
Fundamentally, what do you believe you did differently than you would have otherwise?
I really focused in on that third proposition of conflict offers a choice. And I was able to mentally move very quickly from adversarial to finding the common ground. And the common ground was that we both wanted to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to really make that transition quickly. And I was tickled about it because it really relieved me of anxiety, and it took us to a different level in the project and in our relationship. Instead of kind of tear down the relationship, it actually built a little bit more trust.
Mm-hmm. How did the contractor react to...
He was surprised.
Mm-hmm. Surprised that you didn't yell at him?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, because I really had the impulse, and I was about to let go when I realized that the deadline hadn't been met.
But I think he realized when I said, give me a minute, that I was really trying to make a switch. I don't think he really knew how I was going to do it, or even if I was going to be successful, but I could see him reacting to that step back.
Wow, that is really a great story and so simple.
Yeah, yeah, it really was. Those five propositions, keeping them in mind, you know, I don't think of them as rules. I just thought of them as tools,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I could really rely on. And if I could keep them in my head in any situation, I could really quickly move from a personal adversarial position to one in which the person and I are focused on an issue, mm-hmm. not each other.
10 down and 2 to go. This is the Highlights Show from episodes 1 through 12 of Conflict, the radio program that explores and showcases constructive approaches to addressing the inevitable conflict we all face in life and in all sizes of communities. Just 2 weeks ago, we heard from director of the National Consensus Initiative, Rob Fursch, telling us about just an amazing initiative designed to create a consensus council for the United States Congress. Now, when you think of consensus, that's a pretty tricky concept. Does it suggest that everybody agrees? Well, I guess it does. But moreover, it allows for pulling from different perspectives, different points of view, and actually finding overlapping interests that are already in common. So a big misclaimer about a consensus approach is that people have to compromise in order to go into it. And in fact, what we learned from Rob is that's not the case. They prefer people to go into a consensus process without compromising on anything, with simply going in and trying to get what they want out of it. And by virtue of how it's facilitated, ideally, overlapping interests can be uncovered and solutions can be devised that in fact do address the interests of everyone involved. Here we're going to hear a short clip from Rob Fursch discussing briefly what the U.S. Consensus Council idea is. A consensus council, what is that?
Well, in this context, what we're talking about is a place that Congress would actually establish, it would authorize and even fund, a place where it could send certain issues where it wants help in terms of finding good public policy solutions. It's modeled, Sean, on a series of state-level consensus councils have been successful. And in fact, one of the founders of a state consensus council in Montana is helping to lead the drive at the national level to create a U.S. consensus council. And in a nutshell, here's the idea. The idea is that when Congress faces certain issues that either are so polarized as to be gridlocked, or potentially so complex that it cuts across jurisdiction, and it's having trouble finding solutions that work to the benefit of large numbers of people, it could use an organization like the U.S. Consensus Council, which will have staff and other people working for it who have great expertise in finding common ground and building consensus. It could send that issue over, and if after a careful assessment the Consensus Council thinks it's a good issue it could take on, then the Consensus Council would gather all the major stakeholders and try to engage in a process of building trust amongst the parties, identifying the differences, and eventually trying to find areas of agreement where people from across the spectrum on a particular issue might come to common ground, might come to agreement. And if they do so, then that would be the basis of some recommendations mm-hmm. back to Congress for action.
And just last week, Ambassador John McDonald, chairman of the Institute for Multitrack Diplomacy, came on the program to share clear and convincing examples of successful approaches to international conflicts around the world. Here, he discusses an adventure-based intervention used to build mutual respect and constructive productivity among youth from Bosnia.
And he said, why don't we select some 35 young Bosnians who we had been working there and had a small staff and so forth. And we want them, male and female, from all three communities, all three religions and all three ethnic backgrounds, and take them to this canoe camp and try to help them experience the great outdoors and learn about conflict resolution, and then go off on a five-day wilderness experience into the north where there's nobody for hundreds of miles around. And we did all that. And that five-day experience where they carry their own canoe, their own tent, their food, their sleeping bag, everything on their backs and on their shoulders, and went off in five different groups of canoes all ethnically mixed, young men and young women. And for 5 days, with counselors, of course, for 5 days, they were totally alone in the world mm-hmm. and on their own. They never saw anybody for 5 days, no human being. Just water and rocks and portages and brush. And what happened was a very powerful lesson. And they realized that if you wanted to survive in this wilderness, you had to learn how to work together. Pretty important lesson. And so they learned that, and all their ethnic differences dissipated and disappeared. And each one of those five teams bonded by the end of their 5 days together. I think they made relationships for life myself. The time will tell. So they successfully finished the first phase of this project. The second phase was also quite challenging. They went back to their villages and their homes in Bosnia, and they were tasked to think up a small-scale technical assistance project, which they would carry out themselves in their own community. They had to design the project. They had to get permission sometimes from the city council or the mayor or the principal of the high school, depending on what their project was. They had to write up the project. They do a timeline and do a budget. They'd never done any of those things before. And we had three terrific counselors who went over there every month to meet with them. And actually, the group met together every month in one of the three major cities in each of the three parts of the divided society. We met in Sarajevo and Mostar and Banja Luka. So they had the chance to visit the other two, which they had never done before. So this in its act itself of meeting in different places became a very powerful change agent for them in their thinking. And then our wealthy American funded the projects. So they carried these out for 9 months, 10 months, a major learning experience. Mm-hmm. So they learned management skills. They learned presentation skills. They had to present their project to the rest of the group and get permission and approval. And they had to speak on their feet. They had to make a monthly report about their goals for the month and what they'd accomplished the last month, a constant checking. They did beautifully. We've now had 4 years of that, four different cycles. 139 young people, ages 18 to 26, have now completed that process. And I think that's a remarkable change. They came from 65 towns and villages across Bosnia. And so I believe that they are the future leaders of that war-torn country.
And there you have it, folks. 3 months and 12 episodes later, we have managed to cover everything from dialogue projects and film festivals to consensus councils and even canoeing. Well, I hope you are looking forward to the next 12. To give you an idea of the type of shows in the works, we'll hear from experts on specific tools such as mediation and appreciative inquiry. We'll take a look at what's being done in specific environments such as schools and the workplace. And we'll hear from more experts in the field who will discuss things like common ground negotiating strategies and deliberative democracy. We will be taking a short sabbatical, however, and we will return to live programming on Wednesdays, starting Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on January 21st, 2004. In the meantime, please visit www.conflictradio.org to listen to full-length archived programs of the first season of Conflict. And spread the word. Tell your family, tell your friends and colleagues to check out the program. You can also sign up to receive email updates by sending a request to subscribe@conflictradio.org. As always, if you have any suggestions for future programming, we'd love to hear them. Please send them to ideas@conflictradio.org. From the studios of WGMU Radio, 650 AM from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and worldwide on WGMUradio.com, I'm Sean Dunning. It has been a pleasure serving as the host of Conflict, and I look very much forward to new and exciting episodes yet to come. Until then, thanks for listening, and have a safe and harmonious holiday season.